My name is Matthias Walsh, and this is Animates. Today we'll be broaching the subject of guide dogs, diving into the specifics of what it's like to care for one and have one care for you. My first guest is Graham Innes. He was Australia's National Disability Discrimination Commissioner from 2005 until 2014. He's currently a lawyer, a mediator, and is himself vision impaired and uses the aid of a guide dog. Graham, why are only certain types of dogs chosen for guide dog duty?
Well, I'm probably not necessarily the best person to answer that question, but my understanding is that Labradors and German Shepherds and similar dogs like that, which are chosen, are about the right size for a guide dog, and that's a breed of dog that are very good at routines, and that's largely what guide dogs need to do. They need to perform routines and do that very rigorously. Now, by routines, I don't just mean walking particular routes, because guide dogs are very good at repeating routes and walking the same route, but they also can be taken on new routes. But they have to follow certain routines, that is, walking along a footpath to the left, making sure that there's enough room on their right-hand shoulder for a person who's blind who's holding the harness to follow them, stopping before a step up or a step down and making it clear to the user that that's there, walking around obstacles which are there, and again, leaving enough room for the handler as well as the dog themselves, and not getting distracted when they're doing all of those things, and also being able to follow a basic set of commands, you know, forward, left, right, etc., which you need to use when you're handling a guide dog and working with them.
You mentioned routes there. Like, how would you go about introducing a new route for a guide dog? Like, is it difficult? Do they have to know it beforehand?
No, they don't. I mean, it depends on the caliber of dog and the confidence of the handler. But as with anyone else, people who are blind or vision impaired need to travel routes that they haven't travelled before, and I certainly do that, you know, in my work and in my general life. And so it's important to understand that the person making the decisions, the vast majority of the decisions, is the handler. So I'm deciding where we turn left and where we turn right and where we cross roads and do all those sorts of things. So it's me that's navigating from one place to another. Now, when you're on a familiar route, for instance, you know, my walk from my home to the station, which I've done hundreds of times, then, you know, the dog largely takes over because it gets to know that route. But if I'm going somewhere different, then I work out where it is that I want to go, and I give the dog the commands to tell it what I want it to do. If I have a problem finding a particular building, then I would need to ask, but that's a last resort. I use my own senses of where I am. I use GPS technology, and I use, you know, basic common sense about the way that cityscapes and landscapes work. And as a last resort, if I can't work it out myself, I will ask someone.
Why do some visually impaired people choose for the aid of a guide dog and some don't?
Having a guide dog as a mobility aid is a great tool for independence, and it makes your orientation and mobility significantly easier. But it's not a one-way street, and there are downsides. You have to look after the dog. You've got to feed and care for the dog. You've got to groom the dog. You've got to take the dog to the toilet regularly, and depending on where a person's living, all of those things can be a task. And you're going to have a dog in your home all the time, and that's going to impact on you and your family. And many people choose not to have that. Many people who are blind or vision impaired operate quite independently using a white cane, and I did for about the first 40 years of my life, and was quite happy with that as a form of mobility. But the difference with using a white cane is that, well, there are two key differences, I think. The first is that using a white cane is pretty much full-on concentration the whole time. And I found that as my as I moved up in my career and my stress levels at work increased, I wanted to find ways to reduce the stress, and moving to a guide dog was one way to do that. Because guide dogs make the process far more relaxed, because they're doing a lot of the object finding and avoiding. You've still got to be concentrating, particularly in a new environment. But, you know, on the way home from the railway station or on the way from my office to the station or whatever, I can sort of switch to automatic pilot mode far more, and it's a much more relaxed experience. So people individually make that decision, and as I say, it's a trade-off.
I've been wondering, how do you deal with friendly strangers who want to, like, pet your guide dog without permission? Because I imagine that must happen, I mean, quite a bit.
It does happen quite a bit, and unfortunately it's probably the biggest problem that you have as a guide dog handler, because of course that distracts the dog, and if the dog is distracted, it's not doing its work properly, and if it's not doing its work properly, that puts my safety at risk. The guide dog organisations run significant public relations campaigns encouraging people not to interact with or pat the dog or talk to the dog. And those of us who use guide dogs do the same thing. In fact, often people, if I ask for directions, people will tell the dog the directions rather than me. And I make it clear that that's not appropriate either, that it's me that's making the decisions about directions and that it's me that's handling the dog. But, you know, it's an ever-continuing process to raise that awareness amongst the public.
Well, other than, you know, people petting the dog without your permission, what are some of the other major challenges that present themselves for someone who uses the aid of a guide dog?
I guess the other challenge for me is that people want to interact with the dog rather than interacting with me, and I find that pretty inappropriate, so I try and try to discourage that. I have a practice of not telling people my guide dog's name, because I don't want them to use her name. That's what she responds to very well. I want to maintain that. I don't want other people talking to her when I'm in dangerous situations, crossing roads or you know, navigating objects or whatever else. So not all blind or vision impaired people do that, but that's the approach that I take.
What's the initial process of obtaining a guide dog? Like, how do you choose one, and what are the costs?
The costs are borne by the organisation that trains the dog, and there are about six or seven of those different organisations throughout Australia. They determine the cost of training a guide dog at about $35,000 per dog. So there isn't a cost to me for the actual animal. I bear the ongoing costs of, you know, food and vet fees and grooming, and I have the dog bathed every fortnight because she's going into offices and other public places, and she's got to be appropriately clean. To obtain a dog, you apply to the guide dog organisation of your choice, and they sort of select and recommend a dog, which you don't have to accept, but usually their selection processes are pretty good based on your height, you know, your weight, the dog that's going to work best for you, personality matching, etc., etc.
How long did it take you to feel comfortable to use the aid of your guide dog? What was the learning curve like?
Well, I've had three dogs now, or I'm on my third dog.
Right.
The first one I got was obviously a longer learning curve, because before that I'd used a white cane. So it probably took me 3 to 4 weeks to get used to navigating, you know, with a dog rather than with the cane. It's a very different way of navigating. With the cane, you're using it a bit like a radar. You know, you're probing in front of you all the time to look out for objects, for steps, and et cetera, et cetera. With the dog, it's a bit more like, I don't know, you're holding onto a handle and walking along next to... the thing it's most similar to is being guided by another person. So when I'm guided by another person, I hold onto their arm and just walk along next to them. And when I'm guided by the dog, I hold onto the dog's harness or the handle on the dog's harness. The difference is, if I'm being guided by another person, the other person sort of makes the decisions around where we'll go. Whereas when I'm being guided by a dog, I've got to give the dog directions as to where I want to go. So The initial training, or the training with your initial dog, takes 3 to 4 weeks, but with my second and third dog, I didn't need to go through that process again. So it probably took 2 to 3 weeks, but not as much time on each day, having a lesson working with the dog. I was able to adapt much more quickly.
Was there any hiccups along the way when you were getting used to the dog? Did it take you a while to learn to trust the dog?
The first one, it did longer than the other two. Not because of the dog, but more to do with me getting used to this different process and relying on a dog to make a lot of decisions that I had made. It takes about 6 to 12 months to get the team working as well as it's going to. You know, the dog and the human working as well as they're going to. I mean, I remember with my first dog, I had It's learning what they can and can't do and how much trust and responsibility you give them. I remember on one occasion I was trying to find a particular place and I relied on my dog to find it. She'd been there before and she couldn't find it at all, so she made a hopeless job of doing that. And then the next day I was going somewhere else. And I relied on her again, and she just nailed it first time. So it's working out where the boundaries are, what the dog can do, encouraging the dog to work to its limits, but realizing that at some point, you know, you're going to have to take over as the handler and give the dog support.
You mentioned you had multiple guide dogs. At what age does a guide dog generally retire? What happens to both the guide dog and the owner after that point?
Guide dogs, when they come to you, they've completed their training, are about 18 months old. So they do around 12 months what they call puppy raising or socialising, and they live with a family to do that. And they're taught, I suppose, basic dog skills and routines, toilet trained inside, not to go to the toilet inside the house and to behave appropriately. And families, you know, take them out and into other places, shopping centres and offices and places like that to socialise them. And then they do about 3 to 4 months of intensive training with a guide dog instructor, and they tend to do that at the guide dog centre. I use the Guide Dogs New South Wales guide dog, and so their training centre is in Clissodia out near Windsor. Once that dog has completed that training, then they come to the person, and they usually, subject to health and injury issues, they usually work till around the age of 10. So you have the dog for about, 8.5 years. Now, yeah, that can vary depending on how well the dog's working and whether there are any medical concerns. And once you've got the dog working well in a team, you want to work with that dog for as long as you can, because the training, the time it takes to get used to working with another dog is significant. Some people keep their retired guide dogs at home. I did with my first one when we lived in a house with a nice backyard. But with my second dog, we were living by that stage in an apartment, and it wasn't really appropriate to keep two dogs at home. Also, this dog, my second dog, Arrow, had some arthritis issues, and she was better off in a warmer climate. So she actually lives with a friend of mine up in Brisbane now, and she's enjoying her retirement up there. I get to see her regularly, but I didn't keep her with me. If people want to keep the dogs, the guide dog organisation are usually quite happy with that. But if they don't, then they'll take them and find another family. And because they're such a well-trained dog, it's not hard to find someone to mind the dog.
What aspect of having a guide dog do you find most beneficial to your day-to-day activities?
I think the smoothness of the process of moving from place to place and the speed at which I can do it. I travel a lot in my work, and when I was a commissioner at the Human Rights Commission, I travelled even more. And being able to navigate relatively seamlessly through airports and hotels and places like that without having to have full-on 100% concentration all the time just makes the process of orientation and mobility easier and smoother. I think that's what I find the biggest benefit of having a dog. And I love walking, but when I walked by myself with a white cane, it was always a chore. It was hard work. Now I just get to walk for the pleasure of walking, and I'll often, you know, it's my main form of exercise. I'll just often go out for a walk for the pleasure of doing that, whereas I didn't do that in the past when I used a white cane.
After chatting with Graham, I wanted to learn more about the training of guide dogs and what it's like before they end up in the hands of their eventual owners. My next guest is Paul Adrian. He's the Guide Dog Services Manager for the training facility out of Glossodia. He's been working with guide dogs for over 30 years. So Paul, what exactly does your job entail as Guide Dog Services Manager?
My role at the Guide Dog Centre out at Glossodia is primarily to manage the production of our guide dogs. That involves everything from breeding, the raising of our puppies, our kennel facility, and all of the training up until the point the dogs are ready to be placed with clients.
Paul, you mentioned breeding back there. Do you mind going into a bit of detail about that?
It's only about 5 years ago that Guide Dogs New South Wales started our own breeding program, and I think every dog guide provider in the country now has some form of purpose breeding program. We use genetic material, often frozen semen, and dogs from schools all over the world. And really, we're all part of a program worldwide to breed dogs that are most suitable for the role of being a guide. And that includes not only their having superior health, but also the right sort of temperament to be effective in the role. The whole issue of breeding is becoming more and more scientific as time goes by. Over time, we're hoping to use what are called EBVs, or estimated breeding values, which are a way of determining which characteristics of a dog can actually be selected for within a breeding program, or characteristics to which selection pressure can be applied, and then selecting those breeding dogs that will give us the best result on those characteristics. So it may be possible for us, for instance, to breed dogs with lower levels of distractibility, which, of course, for a guide dog handler would be a fabulous characteristic if we could select for that. We're participating using a database which is called the International Working Dog Register, and we're able to access data on the behaviour and health characteristics of related dogs from all over the world, and that's many, many thousands of related dogs working in guide dog schools all over the world. It's a pretty exciting area of the business, very, very challenging, and one of the reasons, of course, why our dogs are actually quite expensive to produce.
What's the average day look like for the trainers and the dogs? What's the training like for the dogs, and what techniques are used to train them?
So the average day for a dog is we run a kennels out here, and we have about anything up to 60 dogs on site at once. So our day begins at 8 o'clock. Dogs are let out from the kennels, and I would say some of the dogs are not that keen to come out of the kennels. They're climate controlled. We have pipe music. We have it's a very relaxed place for dogs to make sure that they're as comfortable and as least stressed as possible, so that they can perform their best. But they come out from their kennels about 8 o'clock with the trainers and the kennel staff. They're toileted, have a little bit of a play and a bit of exercise before they're put into the training vans and driven out to one of our training grounds. Our training grounds are mixed, so dogs in the early parts of training will be working in very quiet areas where they're just acquiring the skills and learning how to perform those skills without too many distractions. So that's probably a quiet residential area. But as the training progresses, and our training program's around 20 weeks duration, as that training progresses, the dogs are taken to busier areas, shopping centres, and malls, and even to the city and on public transport, so that they can practice their newly acquired skills in more and more complex areas as time goes by. Most dogs get in the vicinity of 30 to 45 minutes of formalised training each day.
Really, that little?
It sounds like a little, but it is actually quite. It's more than enough for the dog in terms of formal on the street training. They're concentrating really hard, and it's actually really interesting to note, Matt. If we take a dog out and give it a half hour free run, you would think that would burn off a lot of energy for the dog, and then he'd want to have a good sleep. I can assure you, half an hour of actual formal training will leave the dog far more tired than half an hour of running around on a beach or at a park. It's actually quite, it really consumes their energy. They really work hard. And the other thing that really surprises me still after so many years is how quickly these dogs acquire the skills. They are really, really clever animals. And I think as we have got better over, and certainly during the period of my career, we've got a lot better at understanding and training dogs. Our capacity to teach dogs faster and have those behaviours stick to be more robust has got better and better and better. In days gone by, we focused very much on the training of the dog and rather than the holistic management of the dog. Today, we look at it more as a performance science. So if you're going to get the best performance from an athlete, you need to think about diet, you need to think about exercise, you need to think about the right relaxation, the right sleep, the right massage therapy, the right supplements. Everything goes into getting that peak performance, the right training as well.
So around what percentage of dogs graduate their guide dog training?
So from our colony, we have two programs. We have our guide dog training, but we also have a therapy dog stream as well. So around about 65% of our dogs are going to be used either in our guide dog program, in our therapy dog program, or importantly, and probably most importantly of all, are selected as replacement breeders for our breeding colony. Because any dog that goes into our breeding colony should be a dog that would make a successful guide if we chose to use the dog in that space. So, around about 65% of our dogs are successful in one of our two programs or two primary programs.
So what happens to the other 35%?
In most cases, those dogs find a good home with their puppy raisers, and that's a bit of a mixed blessing for us, because often if a puppy raiser takes their puppy back as their forever dog, then they may not be able to puppy raise for us again, which is a disappointment for us. But the majority of dogs that don't get through the program do go back to puppy raisers. When, on the very rare occasion that they don't, we have a really, really, really long list, Matt, of people who are looking for a dog. So we're able to ensure that any dog from our program finds a really, really good home and under the same conditions that it's used to. So our dogs our puppies are all sleeping indoors. They're all indoor dogs, as they will be as guides. So we ensure that even the pet dogs that we place are going to homes where they'll be loved and cared for in the way that they have been.
Do the trainers and the dogs form a strong bond? Is it hard for the dogs to leave their trainers and go to completely new people? And also, is it hard for the trainers to leave their dogs, you know, after they've been with them for however many months?
Well, that's a great question, Matt. And the funny thing is, it's probably easier for the dogs than for the trainers. The dogs have undergone a couple of changes along their life journey. They've been with the puppy raiser they've been with their mothers initially and then gone to puppy raising families. They've left their puppy raising families and come to the trainers, and from the trainers they go to their ultimate clients. So they're a little bit accomplished at making the change, and they usually, although the change can be a little difficult for them, They do make that switch after a few days, and generally, particularly with the guide dog users, they bond incredibly strongly with their handlers, because they spend so much time in their company. So they go from, you know, when they're with their trainer, there might be four or five or six dogs that the trainer's working with, sharing their time between those four or five, six dogs. When they go to their client, of course, they're usually going to be the primary single dog, or they might be in a two-dog family. So they get so much more attention and so much more love and care that they bond really, really quickly. So for the dogs, it's relatively seamless. But for our puppy raisers and for our trainers, it is tough because they do form a very close bond with their dogs. They come to this industry because they're interested in dogs or have affection for dogs. So, yes, they do have sometimes a little bit of trouble separating, but, you know, then they get another group of dogs and they soon discover that like there's enough, our hearts are big enough to accommodate more than one dog in our life. And I recall from my early days that the letting go of my first group of dogs was very, very, very difficult, and I shed a few tears as those dogs marched out the door with their clients. But I actually came over time to really enjoy that part of the process because I saw how happy those dogs were in a very short period of time, and how much better their lives were the company of their new owners, rather than being in a kennel and sharing their or having me share my time between so many of them.
I mean, do you think that's the most difficult part of your job? If not, what would be?
I think standing at the kennels on a freezing morning at 8 o'clock is probably one of the hardest parts of the job. Now, I think that probably is the hardest part of the job in many ways, Matt. We have a lot of our heart invested in this. So particularly for new players, for people who are young to the industry, and particularly for our puppy-raising families who have these dogs in their families for 12 months, we become incredibly emotionally attached to these animals. And giving them up is really quite challenging. If you were to ask me what is the most rewarding part of my job, I'd say that's also the most rewarding part of my job, because seeing the joy and the benefit that these dogs ultimately bring to the next person, whether it be as a guide dog, as a pets as therapy dog, or even as a pet dog, is fabulous.